Chapter 5. Know when to hold 'em and when to fold 'em. In Russian physiologist Ivan Pavlov's original experiments on classical conditioning, he ended up conditioning dogs to salivate when a bell was rung. Over time, with the ringing of a bell at mealtime, the dogs connected the noise with the notion that food was on its way. Pair a stimulus with a positive response, and you get dogs drooling in anticipation of food once that bell is rung, even if it never comes. Decades later, Richard Solomon's lab at the University of Pennsylvania was investigating a close cousin to classical conditioning, only with a negative twist. Instead of tying the ringing of a bell to food being on its way, the playing of a tone was associated with receiving an electric shock. They were testing fear conditioning. A sound was played, the dogs were shocked. Over and over, until the tone became a warning sign that a shock was on its way. 24 hours later, the conditioned dogs were placed in a box with only a short barrier keeping them in. It was easily escapable. Solomon's lab believed with fear conditioning, the dogs would try to run, jump, or do whatever it took to get away once they heard the tone. A shock was on the way, after all. Except the dogs didn't try to escape. The tone was played, and the dogs just sat there. Martin Seligman and Stephen Mayer were two young graduate students who had just joined Solomon's lab. They were convinced that a profound failure to escape was the phenomenon to study. Perplexed by the apathy of dogs who knew a tone meant a painful shock, Seligman and Mayer sought to figure out what was going on. In a series of experiments, they again delivered shocks to dogs, but this time, instead of being trapped, they gave some of them a way out. For half of the dogs, if they wanted to avoid the pain, to turn the shock off, all they had to do was press their heads against a panel. These dogs quickly learned how to end the experiment. For the other half, the panel didn't work. They had to sit there, unable to control when the shocks would start or end. They experienced seemingly random shocks throughout their testing time. One group of dogs could escape. The others were trapped and had to endure. Following their experience in the shock apparatus, both sets of dogs were put inside a cage consisting of two rectangular compartments separated by a small wooden barrier only a couple of inches high. The cruel game of shocks and avoidance wasn't over. This time, a shock was delivered through the floor to one compartment, but not the other. Unlike the first go-round, to avoid the shock, every dog had the same opportunity. Hop over the small wooden barrier to the other chamber, and pain was avoided. For all, safety was just a step away. What Seligman and Mayer found was astonishing. The dogs that learned to escape shocks in the initial experiment by pressing a panel did the sensible thing in the latter experiment. They jumped the barrier to safety. The dogs that had no way to end the shocks in the initial experiment, despite having the same opportunity and capability to hop to safety, they didn't. Over two-thirds of the dogs didn't even attempt to find an escape, even after 10 trials. And the ones who eventually figured out they could escape took nearly until the end of the experiment, where their counterparts figured it out on the first shock. The poor dogs who struggled to escape became listless, whining and cowering in the corner. They had lost the ability to try. Seligman and Mayer stumbled upon a phenomenon they called learned helplessness. The dogs had learned that pain and suffering were outside of their control. They had no power over what was happening to them, so their only point of recourse was to sit there and take it. The same phenomenon has been replicated in other animals. When researchers shocked rats the exact same amount, those who could not press a lever to escape demonstrated a greater stress response and double the amount of gastric ulceration. When the rats lacked control over their fate, they mimicked the dogs. They stopped trying to escape their situation. The pattern was clear. Take away control, and animals resign themselves to their fate. They give up, even if the path to avoiding despair is right in front of them. Our modern workplaces, sports leagues, and even schools often train us to respond in the same manner. They, like the old model of toughness, often rely on control and constraint. They take choice away. It's the dictatorial coach who motivates through fear and punishment, the boss who micromanages, the company that tracks every minute that a worker is on task and when they click away to Facebook, the parent who restricts and controls their child so much that they cut off their natural inclination to exploration. It turns out, when control and choice are taken away from humans, we act just like the helpless dogs in the experiment. We lose the ability to try. Lack of control extinguishes the flame of even the most motivated. When we lack control, when we feel like no matter what we do, it doesn't make any difference, our brain is getting the message, what's the point? In our modern workplace, we see the transformation before our eyes. The young and enthusiastic junior staffer gradually transforms into the mindless occupant of a cubicle. We move from thriving to surviving. There's a reason that burnout is rampant in just about every profession. We have spent years training hopelessness in the misguided name of discipline. A new approach is needed, one that is based on giving back and bolstering autonomy, one that allows us to unlock the tools to navigate through discomfort. Give up itis. In 1606, 105 men set sail aboard the Susan Constant, Godspeed, and Discovery to traverse the Atlantic Ocean and establish Jamestown, the first permanent English colony in the New World. Surviving a four-month journey, the mix of gentlemen, blacksmiths, carpenters, and all-around handymen established their new home on the banks of the James River on May 13, 1607. Given the failed expeditions that preceded the Jamestown colonists and the inherent risk and danger of traveling to a still unexplored land across a vast sea, the adventurers were well aware of the danger before them. At the end of the first year, only 38 of the original settlers remained alive. Despite the astronomical death rates, colonists kept coming. As a colony, Jamestown faced long odds. They experienced severe drought, difficulty in establishing crops, infiltration of disease-spreading mosquitoes, and hostile situations with Native Americans. Despair, isolation, starvation, and death all were commonplace. In letters sent back home, colonists reported lethargy and apathy spreading throughout the settlement. In a letter from 1610, William Strachey writes of extreme idleness and inability of settlers to sow corn for their own bellies, nor to put a root, herb, etc. for their own particular good in their gardens or elsewhere. While another colonist reported a few years later that most give themselves over and die of melancholy. Looking back on this harsh period, the common explanation for the constant reports of apathy and laziness are either that starvation sapped colonists of any energy and desire for work, or that the colonists were unprepared for the harsh realities of the New World. Modern historian Karen Kupperman has a different take. While starvation was a real and constant threat, what if the psychobiological toll of living with death and despair as constant partners led to death itself? As Kupperman outlined in her paper, Apathy and Death in Early Jamestown, there was a brief respite in the astronomical death rates of early Jamestown. When John Smith, adventurer and later legend of the Pocahontas tale, took charge with a new motto, work or starve, deaths briefly subsided. Requiring each settler to put in 4 hours of farming per day, Smith later reported that only 7 or 8 men died during his 10 months in charge, a drastically lower rate than before or after. Smith made the case that idleness and carelessness were the real cause for concern in Jamestown. Others seemed to agree. In 1620, colonist George Thorpe reported, "More do die here of disease of their mind than of their body." Was the simple desire to live not enough to motivate the Jamestown settlers to lift themselves up and farm for the sake of their own survival? Or were they helpless? In the Korean War, prisoners of war experienced a new disease. The patients succumbed to a sensation of listlessness, as if emotion and life itself had been drained out of them. Over time, they would fade, foregoing their daily routines and giving up on their hygiene. Even their movements took on a zombie-like pattern, feet lifting off the ground as minimally as possible, as if to conserve every ounce of energy. The disease had no signs of organ failure or identifiable internal distress, but the prognosis was grim. Death. The disease was give-up-itis. Give-up-itis didn't originate in the Korean War. Similar reports abound from those who face extreme traumatic experiences. During World War II, those who suffered through concentration camps reported comparable experiences, tales of friends whose inner light would slowly fade as they transformed into listless beings. More recently, individuals who were lost at sea report shipmates who didn't survive the journey experiencing a similar phenomenon. In 2018, psychologist John Leach tracked the history and science of this phenomenon in a report entitled Give-up-itis Revisited. According to Leach, sufferers of give-up-itis progress through a series of 5 stages. It starts with a general withdrawal before turning into apathy, loss of emotional response, and a lack of response to any external stimulus. Along the way, motivation to do menial tasks erodes until the simplest of tasks can no longer be completed. Listlessness takes over. The last stage is psychogenic death. The strange case of give-up-itis is easy to dismiss. Dying of a lack of motivation to continue living doesn't fit well with our medical minds. We need a cause, a failure of an organ, a disease that spreads. But we saw the same phenomenon in dogs who were put through shocks and torment, a descent into a passive state where escape is unthinkable. And in other research, rats conditioned for learned helplessness gave up and drowned within minutes when placed in a water tank, even though they demonstrated the ability to swim for much longer, some for hours on end. Give-up-itis might not always lead to death, but the feelings of apathy when we lack control are real and frequent. In a sad twist, the CIA incorporated these findings in the brutal interrogation techniques, such as waterboarding, that were utilized in the early 2000s. According to a Senate report, the CIA hoped to eliminate any sense of control and predictability to create learned helplessness and apathy. There may be a cure for give-up-itis. Psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl noted that when he was in Auschwitz, another prisoner told him that to increase his chances of survival, he should do 2 simple things: shave and stand tall. In other words, control what you can. Not too dissimilar from the advice that John Smith gave to his Jamestown colleagues. Leach believes that bringing some sort of normalcy to perilous situations requires an appraisal that the person has at least some control over his situation, has not accepted mental defeat. He goes on to conclude, that sensation of choice indicates a reversal of mental defeat and the reimposition of some personal control over the situation, which is a key factor in recovery. Give-up-itis is the clinical expression of mental defeat. In particular, it is a pathology of a normal, passive coping response. Give-up-itis isn't restricted to those moving to distant lands or experiencing extreme acts of survival. In many ways, it's the scourge of modernity. No, death isn't the end result here, but listlessness sure is. Work is no longer 9-to-5. Emails have to be answered at all times. We are constantly on, constantly connected. If you don't respond to a parent, boss, or customer at nearly any hour of the day, you're in trouble. We're expected to grind endlessly in our pursuit. And if we feel overwhelmed, there are dozens of others lined up for a shot at our job. In the modern workplace, we give away any sense of autonomy in exchange for the right to grind for a few extra bucks. As work infiltrates all aspects of life, we are actively training learned helplessness. When we feel like we have no say or choice, we're on the path toward listlessness. We are the dogs who learned that no matter how many times we press the button for help, no one is coming. It's no wonder difficult decisions now seem overwhelming, or why many of us struggle to get out the door to exercise or even do the dishes at night. We blame it on lack of will or motivation. But the truth is, when we lack a sense of control over our life, apathy naturally takes over. Choosing to be tough. After receiving his MD from Emory University in 1962, Peter Bourne served in the U.S. Army for 3 years during the Vietnam War, a conflict that epitomized the terrors of war in an environment that was unlike other recent conflicts. Surprise and ambush replaced the structured wars of years past. For someone with a keen interest in how individuals responded to stress, Vietnam served as the perfect place for Bourne to understand how the body reacts to such perils. With their camp situated on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a direct supply route for the Viet Cong, Bourne began taking daily measurements of the stress hormone cortisol in a handful of soldiers, officers, and radio operators in anticipation of an impending attack. Bourne was trying to understand how the body anticipated and responded to stress, but also how it recovered. Once that inevitable attack finally came, Bourne continued tracking stress hormone levels as the fighting subsided and normalcy returned. When he compared the cortisol response among the different groups, a pattern emerged. The soldiers all saw their cortisol levels drop significantly on the day of the expected attack, while the radio men and the officers experienced the opposite, an increase. After the attack, the soldiers' cortisol levels increased, while the officers decreased, both returning to baseline. The radio operators remained elevated even after the attack had concluded. All the men were in the same camp, experiencing the same environment, expecting the same attack, yet they had different stress responses. Bourne believed that the difference lay in the level of perceived control. Through a combination of training and circumstances, the soldiers were able to cope with the impending raid. Fighting was what they had prepared for. They'd been drilled and drilled on what to do. Their job wasn't to design the plan or develop tactics. It was to follow orders. And they had an inherent belief that if they followed their instructions, they would succeed. They were the best trained army in the world, after all. They didn't have time to ruminate on the issue. Like John Smith's Jamestown colonists centuries earlier, the soldiers had tasks to complete. They had to prepare their camp, ensure their defensive perimeter was stout, and prepare their weapons. Thanks to training, they felt like they had a degree of control over a hazardous situation. Officers didn't have this luxury. It may seem like they would have more control, but when it came to impacting the potential outcome, the officers had less. They had more information and intelligence than the soldiers on the ground. But they received orders from higher command and then made their best guesses on strategy and tactics and hoped it would work. Similarly, the radio men were reporters of information. They were the go-betweens, important, but they had little say in or impact on what was going on out on the battlefield. Our level of control changes how we respond to stress, not just on the battlefield, but in every aspect of our life. Think. The middle manager who feels trapped between her boss's dictates and the worker's needs, or the teacher who is told not to deviate from the approved standardized curriculum, even though their students are falling further and further behind. When we lack control, our stress spikes. When we have a sense that we can impact the situation, our cortisol response is dampened. Control doesn't alter just our hormonal response, but also the experience that accompanies stress. When researchers peered into the brains of subjects with fMRI machines, they found that when pain was controllable, participants had lower rates of anxiety, along with a decreased response in the threat-sensing area of the brain, amygdala. They had not only a lower alarm response from the amygdala, but also a better-equipped controller, the prefrontal cortex, that was able to step in and put out the fire much more quickly. When we have a sense of control, our alarm is quieter and easier to shut off. Control alters not only our physiological response to stress, but also our ability to persist. When we believe we have influence over an outcome, we're more likely to persevere, even if we face a setback. The traditional test of endurance capacity is a VO2 max test. It's a cruel task that's been a staple of exercise physiology for a century. Run on a treadmill as the physiologist increases the speed or incline every minute or two until you either choose to stop or fly off the back of the treadmill from pure exhaustion, all while breathing through a mask and tube contraption that measures how robust and efficient your cardiovascular system is. I'd performed several such tests in my running career, but something about them always bothered me. They bear little resemblance to an actual race. When competing out on the track or road, you are in charge of when you speed up or slow down. In the VO2 max test, that choice is taken away. So one day in the fall of 2014, I hopped on the treadmill, determined to do a different kind of test, one that gave the control back to the athlete. In the new test, the goal wasn't to hang on until I cried, "Uncle." It was to exhaust myself in about 10 minutes. I was in charge of pacing, able to increase or decrease the speed or incline as I saw fit. When I hopped on the treadmill, the dread was gone. I was familiar with bringing my body to exhaustion, especially when I knew about where the finish line was. Upon completing the test, not only did I enjoy it more, but how much oxygen my body could take in and utilize was significantly higher. The next step was an obvious one. Ask some athletes I coached if they'd like to be guinea pigs. Over the following week, I put them through two VO max tests, the traditional one where control was in my hands, and the new version where they were in control. When we crunched the data, the athletes who were faster on the track did better in the new style, reaching a higher VO2 max when they had control. On the other hand, those who weren't quite as fast on the track were slightly better in the traditional test. In discussing with the athletes afterward, it was clear the better runners needed freedom. They wanted to explore their limits and be in charge of how they did. For the not quite as fast runners, reducing the task to either persist or quit simplified their goal. They could maintain focus on one thing, to just keep going, which helped their performance. For the more experienced and better runners, this wasn't enough. They needed to be in charge to be able to make a choice to run their best. Toughness maxim. Our level of control changes how we respond to stress. When we have a sense of control, our alarm is quieter and easier to shut off. The science of choice. The ability to choose is not just related to persistence and performance. It is deeply ingrained and required for being a normally functioning human being. The two most prominent theories related to motivation and human flourishing are self-determination theory and self-efficacy. According to self-determination theory, the level of autonomy, or the desire to be causal agents of one's own life, is intricately tied to our well-being. It serves as one of the three basic psychological needs that allow us to flourish and bolster our motivation. In legendary psychologist Albert Bandura's seminal theory of self-efficacy, control plays a similarly large role. According to Bandura, self-efficacy reflects confidence in the ability to exert control over one's own motivation, behavior, and social environment. Both theories are tied to motivation, work performance, happiness, well-being, life satisfaction, and academic success. When we feel like we can have an impact on whatever it is we do, we are better off. The ability to have control is central not only to overcoming adversity, but also to being a happy, healthy human being, and it's reflected in our brains. When we are given a choice, our brain responds as if having a choice is the reward in and of itself. The striatum, an area linked to reward processing, activates when we have the ability to choose. In the lab, when we are given a reward for choosing the right answer, our striatum lights up. When we are given that same reward based on luck or chance, the striatum remains silent. The ability to choose improves performance not only in athletic tasks, but also in everyday ones. Giving nursing home residents more autonomy and choice over their care and their surroundings improves mood, alertness, and well-being. While in the workplace, those who report feeling more autonomy and less micromanaging have higher levels of job satisfaction and performance. We have a deep need to be in control over our environment, and in particular, our lives. When we give away this sensation, we lose a sense of ourself. And if we repeatedly do so, we lose our ability to respond even to the simplest of challenges. In 2011, when Stephen Mayer, the scientist who pioneered the work in learned helplessness, went back to utilize modern neuroscience to expand on his seminal work, he made a subtle adjustment to his original theory. Learned helplessness implied that the dogs were learning not to try, that after suffering and despair, they'd given up. Mayer and colleagues evaluated rats using a similar shock paradigm to the one they'd used in the 1960s, with some receiving controllable and others uncontrollable shocks. But this time, after going through the shock protocol, they put all the rats in a cage with a juvenile rat while monitoring their brains. When new rats encounter each other, they act similar to dogs, the dominant or older one sniffing the younger one. The rats that received shocks that they could stop or control followed the typical pattern, sniffing their younger counterpart. The rats that received uncontrollable shocks, they cowered in the corner, barely acknowledging the juvenile rat. When Mayer peered inside the rat's brains, he noticed a distinct difference. The dorsal raphe nucleus, DRN area in the brain, lit up and stayed activated in the cowering rats. The DRN is a primitive brain area that responds to stress and releases serotonin into adjacent areas in the brain. Their counterparts, who could stop the shocks, also experienced an initial stress response, but an area in their prefrontal cortex soon lit up, shutting down the DRN's primitive stress response. If you remember from earlier in the chapter, the prefrontal cortex acts as a control, signaling to dampen down the alarm. Mayer took it a step further, stimulating the prefrontal cortex in the rats that had an overactive stress DRN response, thanks to their uncontrollable shocks. All of a sudden, the rats transformed, no longer displaying any characteristics associated with learned helplessness. The alarm had been shut off, quieted down. As Mayer told the American Psychological Association, it's like the forebrain is saying, "Cool it, brainstem, we have the situation under control." The rats and dogs weren't learning how to be helpless. That was their default state. The dogs had to learn that they had control, that they could, in scientific terms, activate their prefrontal cortex, turn on their controller, which allowed them to turn the alarm off. If they felt like they had control over the situation, they wouldn't succumb to the listless apathy that lack of control seems to foretell. We need to train to be able to turn the alarm off. It wasn't learned helplessness. It was learned hopefulness. When life feels like it's spinning out of control, or like the task you have in front of you is insurmountable, it's easy to default to hopelessness, to what's the point? That's natural. Your body evolved to conserve energy. We need to train hopefulness, to clear the path to continue. It doesn't take big heroic efforts to train hope. Small signals that you are in control, that you can have an impact, will be enough to turn our prefrontal cortex back on. If too many emails are causing you consternation, define a specific hour each day in which you'll answer them. If grief has destroyed your motivation, give yourself permission to feel the strong emotions, binge on Netflix, but also to let go. You don't need to be back to normal the day after a major loss, but you can take small steps toward normalcy to flex your control muscle. Going for a walk instead of a full-blown workout, meeting friends for coffee, spending an hour a day diving back into your work project. Too often, we get stuck in the rut of apathy because we haven't flexed our hopeful muscle. Small actions that remind you that you have a choice go a long way to training the ability to put your brain back online. Other research confirms Mayer's findings on the role of the prefrontal cortex. Activation of the prefrontal cortex when experiencing pain reduces our negative emotional response. On the other hand, individuals suffering from depression have a reduced ability to activate their prefrontal cortex. Other research shows that Alzheimer's patients who have reached the stage where apathy is prevalent have reduced activity in their prefrontal cortex. All signs point to the importance of this brain area in helping to regulate not only our emotions, but also the behavioral apathy that comes with them. When we have control and can actively choose, we turn on our prefrontal cortex, giving us the ability to regulate our emotional response to stress or adversity. When we lack the ability to choose, our prefrontal cortex learns to shut off, to let the stress response run wild. It's no wonder that we transform into passive responders to whatever challenge we face. We give up. When we take choice away, our brain learns to be helpless instead of hopeful. In a review on the subject for Trends in Cognitive Sciences, researchers Lauren Leote, Sheena Iyengar, and Kevin Oxner hammer home the importance of the need for control. In their conclusion, they state, "The evidence suggests the desire to exercise control, and thus the desire to make choices, is paramount for survival." They go on to summarize their findings. "The desire for control is not something we acquire through learning, but rather is innate, and thus likely biologically motivated. We are born to choose. We have a basic underlying need to have some semblance of control over whatever we're tackling. Constraining and controlling workplaces take that away, nudging us toward quitting at the first sign of discomfort. Autonomy is the switch that allows us to persist." Training learned hopefulness. Our goal is to be able to walk by every classroom in the hallway, and each is indistinguishable. You should all be teaching the same subject, using the same activity, at the same time period. These instructions might seem like they are from the early 1900s, perhaps for Henry Ford's innovative assembly line. But as you might have guessed, they came from a modern American school. When I spoke to the teachers, they relayed story after story about how they weren't actually allowed to teach. It was more akin to the paint-by-numbers instructions they gave their students. Their day was scheduled to the minute. Their curriculum provided a script to repeat to the children, verbatim, before giving out the pre-planned activity that went along with it. This may come as a surprise, as schools are filled with mission statements and values of individualized learning and meeting students where they are. But with a rising pressure to improve American students' test scores, there has come a backlash of administrative control. Teachers are thought of as messengers for whatever standardized curriculum the school district spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on, believing that the magic is in the material, not in the teacher. Efficiency and control have replaced ingenuity and empowerment. As one teacher relayed to me, "I feel like I could be replaced by anyone with a brain. Follow the script. No deviations from the plan. What did I go to school for? My knowledge and experience are wasted." We are taught mainly to follow, even those who are supposed to be leading and guiding. In athletic pursuits, it's much the same. Venture down to the local high school or college football field and watch any of those teams train during their conditioning time. The coach dictates precisely what's to be done. The athlete has little to no control. The next exercise to do, the amount of weight to lift, the number of wind sprints to run, the amount of recovery, or even when to grab a water bottle, is dictated and controlled. The athlete is taught to follow orders. For less progressive coaches, there might even be punishment for failing to follow through. If an athlete doesn't complete the last sprint in the required time, he or the entire team might have to do another one. Regardless of whether you are on a team with or observing a progressive or regressive coach, what's missing from these common scenarios? Choice. The athletes have none. When it comes to traditional toughness training, coaches envision driving athletes to the brink of exhaustion until they throw up and can't push any longer. This style of training, they often believe, will inoculate players to pain and fatigue. In the workplace, there might not be pushing until puking, but toughness is developed through the grind. Junior-level employees work 80-hour weeks in the name of proving their worth. As one of my coaching clients, an investment banker, told me, interns and new employees use email scheduling apps to send a few very late-night emails to make it appear as if they were working at nearly all hours. While the New York Times reported in 2015 that emails arrived past midnight, followed by text messages asking why they were not answered, the work culture of proving ourselves, impressing upon our superiors that we too can grind, is prevalent across fields. The employees who survive are the ones who are hardy, who can handle the rigors of the workplace. But what's missing is that in such scenarios, the players and workers only have one choice: persist or quit. And because of the power dynamics, that choice is often artificial. It's survival for as long as you can. Like the runners on the treadmill for the VO2 max test, they've limited their ability to be in control. The individuals can't escape, especially if failure, being fired, or being berated is their reward if they don't persist. Instead of training their prefrontal cortexes to be able to turn on, to deal with the negative emotions that fatigue brings about, we are teaching them to be helpless. We've trained them to be the apathetic dog, incapable of hopping over a small gate to safety. Worse yet, it's not just helplessness. By utilizing such tactics, we're teaching people to respond to fear. If the only reason that you persist is to avoid being yelled at, performing a physical punishment, or getting fired, then the message that's ingrained is to be motivated only when someone is in your face yelling or punishment is on the line. When it comes time for game day, when it's just them, alone out there on the field, what reaction do we expect? The one we ingrained. Jim Dennison is a former athlete and sports sociologist who took a slightly different path in looking at performance. Despite witnessing some of the top athletes on the planet, when he became involved in coaches' education as the director of the Canadian Athletics Coaching Center, he didn't believe that coaches needed more training on how to make someone stronger, faster, or fitter. Instead, he and his colleague Joseph Mills looked for inspiration from Michel Foucault, a French philosopher who had likely never discussed athletic performance in his life. When I talked to Dennison about how Foucault could impact athletics coaching, he pointed to the philosopher's views on power. In Foucault's conceptualization, power was utilized to regulate time, space, and effort. In the political environment, he was critical of the effects of power on the individual. He believed that power influenced control, and when power was relinquished, the individual became passive and docile. Dennison and Mills believed the same idea applied to athletes and coaches. As they stated, coaching can easily become a technocratic procedure invested less with a coach's understanding of all that training does and more with his or her power to control, monitor, intervene, regulate, differentiate, and correct his or her athletes. Yet, paradoxically, there is nothing structured and certain about a race. What happens over the course of a distance running race is open to constant change. Athletes have to make untold decisions that relate to their many bodily states. Dennison and Mills continued, "What concerns us, therefore, is how effective a training plan can ever be if the body in the stands, the coach, not the body on the track, the athlete, is in total control of the training process. When athletes compete, they are alone in the competition arena. They make the decisions. Yet in training, the coach takes on the decision-making mantle." Dennison and Mills suggested flipping the concept on its head. No, not by making the athletes in charge of designing their workouts, but by giving a large portion of control back to them. By putting the athletes in a position to choose whether to speed up, slow down, lift another rep, or call it a day, we can take advantage of the power of choice. When we put people in a position to choose, we can switch on and train their prefrontal cortex, allowing them to understand and regulate the sensations of pain, fatigue, and anxiety that often come with such difficult moments. We allow them to try, adjust, perhaps even fail, but above all, learn. In Dennison and Mills' model, the coach shifts from dictating to putting athletes in a situation where they are challenged, but then giving them free rein to find, search, and choose how to cope with the scenario. Dennison and Mills' ideas have merit beyond better performance. A study of over 200 men and women found that when athletes trained in an autonomy-supportive environment, there was a correlation with the satisfaction of their basic psychological needs for well-being. Controlling environments were associated with thwarting an individual's basic needs and with lower overall satisfaction. Furthermore, they found that those in a supportive environment tended to have higher levels of mental toughness and better performances. The key to improving mental toughness does not lie in constraining and controlling individuals. It doesn't lie in developing harsh punishments to teach them a lesson. It doesn't lie in screaming at a person to complete whatever demanding task is in front of them. When we don't have control, we lose the capacity to cope. It's when we have a choice that toughness is trained. Our brain literally turns on, figuring out how to work our way through the situation at hand. We were born to choose, so let us learn how to do it. Toughness maxim. When we don't have control, we lose the capacity to cope. It's when we have a choice that toughness is trained. Training to have control. Whether on the athletic fields or in the workplace, if your goal is to train toughness, you have to give people a degree of autonomy. Suffering or experiencing discomfort on its own isn't enough. To train toughness, we need to develop and maintain a sense of control. Leading yourself. In the four exercises that follow, I've outlined how to develop that sense of control in yourself. 1. From small to large. Take a difficult situation that brings about discomfort. Maybe it's performance-related anxiety or a conversation that you are dreading. What we often do is try to control the thing. So, if anxiety is the issue, we try to attack the nerves and fear. We try to force ourselves to turn down the tension. And then after that doesn't work, our brain comes to the logical conclusion that we have no control over our body or the situation. I can't control my anxiety. So why try? Instead of wrestling the giant monster, start with the smallest item that you can have control over that's related to the problem. Is it your breath? Can you intentionally slow your breathing down? Or maybe it's something as simple as showing up on time or getting through the first mile of your marathon. Break it down to something manageable and feasible. The goal isn't to stop there, but to get a foothold so that you can gradually climb to the next level. Once you have a sense of control over the smallest item, then move to something slightly larger. Move from small to large. 2. Give yourself a choice. Without knowing it, we often box ourselves into a corner, taking any semblance of choice away. We feel trapped, pushed to persist no matter what. Whenever we don't have a choice, we aren't training toughness. If, for example, you say that I have to complete this task by 3 p.m., that might work when completing a manageable task. But when you face something beyond your reach, you're more likely to throw in the towel and say, "This is impossible," instead of persisting. We're often told that when creating a habit, like going to the gym, we need to be rigid and specific. Show up every day at 7 a.m. to work out and never miss a day. But what research shows is having choice, such as I'm allowed to miss 2 days per week if I have to, results in a longer-lasting, more sustainable habit. Katie Milkman, behavioral scientist and author of How to Change, calls this allowing for a mulligan. It's why research shows in dieting that cheat days actually help. All or nothing often leaves you with nothing. Giving yourself a choice sometimes means entertaining the idea of quitting, slowing down, or even giving up. It's not that I want you to do so, but by having a choice, by needing to make a decision, you are developing a sense of control. By considering quitting as an option, you now have influence over the outcome, even if one result is negative. By actively considering quitting, instead of seeing it as something to avoid and never let cross your mind, you are now training toughness. Consider what it would be like to abandon your goal or quit your job. 3. Flip the script. It was the night before the NCAA Regional Cross Country Championships, and my team was about to face off against the best runners in Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana. The women's team came in with their best ranking in over a decade, led by a strong trio who were all on the cusp of achieving all-region status. The only problem, senior Meredith Sorensen was in fantastic shape, but suffering from one of the worst cases of performance anxiety I'd ever seen. 2 weeks before, at the conference championship, while standing on the line awaiting the gun to go off, she turned around, puked all over the ground, then started the race. For Meredith, this was normal. She got so nervous that she couldn't hold her food down. She finished that race in the medical tent with an IV. 2 weeks later, she was cleared physically to race, and I was stumped about how to help Meredith get in a spot where she could compete up to her potential. The night before the race, I met Andy Stover at a local bar. Andy was a former collegiate distance runner and a social worker with a knack for innovative approaches, who also happens to be a groomsman in my wedding. As I relayed all of the traditional techniques I tried with Meredith, preparing her for discomfort, visualization, changing her mindset to see anxiety as excitement, he quipped, "Flip the script, give her back some control." Seeing the puzzled look on my face, Andy continued, "If she throws up before every race, it's become part of the routine. She expects and likely dreads it. So when it happens again and again, all while she's trying everything she can to prevent it, her brain learns she isn't in control. Get her to stop fighting herself. Give her back control." The next day, as Meredith began her warm-up, she came over and said, "I feel like I'm going to throw up." I replied, "Good. When do you want to do it?" Her face turned from worry to puzzlement. "I don't want to." Seeing her confusion, I replied, "I know, but it's going to happen. So what time would you like to throw up? Should it be before your jog, after you do your drills, or maybe right before your strides? Where would you like to insert throwing up into your warm-up routine? The race starts at 10 a.m. What time should I schedule your puking for?" The confused look on her face was still there, but she seemingly accepted and went along with it. 9:45, right before I do my final strides. Trying to appear as confident in this crazy idea as possible, I replied, "Great, 9:45 it is. I'll set my alarm so we both know and can get it done." When 9:45 came, my alarm went off, and I walked over to Meredith, telling her it was time to throw up, so let's get it done. The only thing is, she didn't need to. For the first time in several races, no puking occurred. She wasn't perfect or free of anxiety, but she'd wrestled back enough control where her mind was free to focus on what she was doing and not become preoccupied with the anxiety and puking to come. She went on to have the best race of her career, improving by nearly 20 places over her previous best, and just missing out on a coveted all-region spot by a mere few seconds in the 20-minute race. Away from the running course, you can flip the script by noticing what nudges you toward fear and avoidance. Those triggers are often a signal that we need to flip the script. Feeling like an imposter in your current assignment? Ask good friends if they truly have any idea what they're doing, and chances are they'll tell you they are just making it up as they go. Feeling overwhelmed as you make your company-wide pitch? Tell the audience, at the start of a presentation in front of professional sports coaches and executives, "I put a picture of myself as an 8-year-old playing peewee sports up on the screen and said, 'This was the peak of my soccer knowledge. Everyone in this room knows more than me, so this is a bit nerve-wracking. But I do know about the science of performance, and if you give me a chance, I think it'll help you.'" When we flip the script, we take away the power of the thing. We give ourselves permission to do something that we thought was negative. And often, we find this subtle shift provides us with the freedom to perform. 4. Adopt a ritual. As he stepped into the batter's box, Boston Red Sox star infielder Nomar Garciaparra commenced his painstaking routine. Adjust his batting gloves on both hands, tug on the band on his left forearm, repeat that process again and sometimes again, tap the bill of his batting helmet and various other parts of his body, back to tapping the helmet, make the sign of the cross across his jersey, then windmill his bat until he was ready to swing. Garciaparra isn't the only baseball player with an elaborate batting ritual, or even the only athlete. Tennis stars like Rafael Nadal and Serena Williams have their particular quirks. Tying their shoes in the same manner, water bottles placed in the same spot, and so forth, before they go out to dominate. Why do these bastions of athletic superiority resort to painstaking and seemingly silly rituals? Control. According to the theory of compensatory control, we try to establish order in the outside world in an effort to gain control in the internal. Stepping up to the batter's box, where even the most skilled hitters need a bit of luck, and facing the uncertainty of what 90-mile-per-hour pitch is coming their way, hitters exert influence over the one aspect of the situation they can control. When we utilize rituals, we shift our focus to behaviors that we are in charge of, pushing to the back of our mind the items that we have little control over. Rituals are a coping mechanism for our brain, convincing it that we have more control than we actually do. If you're completing a task with a high degree of uncertainty and a low degree of control, creating a ritual can be a successful way to keep negative inner voices and emotions at bay. Leading others. Much of this book focuses on what we can do to improve our own toughness. But sometimes the degree of control we feel over our life and performance comes partially down to what our boss, coach, or individual in leadership does. If you're leading, you bear the burden of training and empowering control. For that reason, let's quickly cover exercises that will help you develop a sense of control in those you lead or work with. 1. Learn to let go. When you're in a leadership position, be it a coach, principal, or executive, it's tempting to micromanage your way to success, detailing exactly when and what everyone should be doing, and where they should be at all times of the workday. Micromanaging occurs because of a fear that someone else isn't going to do the job. When you dictate and control, you're sending the message, "I don't trust you to do the job." As those in the special forces often say, "Trust but verify." It's a balance between trusting and overmanaging, but we often fall too far on the side of overmanaging. After all, our reputation and ego are on the line if we are leading. Instead, let go of the reins a touch, teach them the skills, and then let them go. Check in occasionally to make sure they are headed in the right direction. Over time, the reins should get longer and longer. Your goal is to put people in a position to do their job. 2. Set the constraints and let them go. Giving away control isn't about letting people run wild with no direction. Set up the boundaries or constraints and then let them go. When a worker is new, this is particularly important. You don't just give someone free rein and hope they come through. Set constraints and let them explore within those, while keeping some control on essential areas that they might not have the requisite skill for yet. For example, in athletics, inform the athlete that they need to complete 10 100-meter repeats, but it's up to them how much rest they have in between. Let them choose. In the workplace, tell those you are managing that you'll work with them to dial in the 3 most important slides for the quarterly report, but give them the freedom to design and develop the rest. I always tell anyone I'm working with that my goal is to make myself obsolete. I'm trying to coach them toward independence, not dependence. It might start small, allowing an athlete to decide on one workout every month. But over time, I gradually hand more and more responsibility to those I work with, guiding them along the way, correcting when they fall off course, but never jumping in and declaring, "See, you need me. It's back to me telling you exactly what you have to do." 3. Allow them to fail, reflect, and improve. Part of giving back control is allowing them to make mistakes. That means giving more autonomy and control in projects that someone can handle. Don't throw them into the deep end with an incredibly demanding task, tell them, "You figure it out," and then watch them sink. Give away control in small bites that eventually grow into something much more significant. Then have a system in place that allows for reflection and growth. In the sports world, after a game, coaches break down the game tape. Good coaches don't scold athletes for making mistakes, as they've already occurred. They use film review as an opportunity to teach someone what to do. In the military, during training, soldiers replace ammunition with paintballs and work through realistic operation simulations. At the conclusion, they go through an AAR, an after-action review, where they break down what went well and what can be improved upon. They don't berate each other for failure in practice. They own it, then get back to work, so they don't make the same mistake again. Giving people space to fail is something that we occasionally do well in the sporting fields, but neglect in the business world. Create conditions that allow for people to mess up and make mistakes in a way that doesn't cause you to lose the big client or big game. When we don't feel in control, our emotions and inner voice spiral. Tasks feel harder, the pain feels more intense, and our doubts seem louder. Our motivation plummets as we head toward apathy and a lack of will to act. It's nearly impossible to be tough when there's no hope of navigating your way through the current situation. It's as if we shrug our shoulders and say, "What's the point?" Being tough is about navigating this experience so that we can keep moving forward. Toughness isn't just about persistence in the face of discomfort. It's about making a good decision. Sometimes the tough decision is to turn around, walk away, and quit. Think of a climber who has spent years preparing for a summit attempt. She gets within a few hundred meters of reaching the top, and her mind and body are urging her forward. "If I can just get to the top," she thinks, while she pushes away the fatigue and doubts. The difficult decision is to lean into those thoughts and feelings and recognize that she doesn't have the energy to reach the summit, and then make it back down the mountain. The ego is pushing her forward. The tough decision is to turn around. We often equate toughness with persistence, but in some cases, it's the exact opposite. Toughness is navigating the inner turmoil in order to make a good decision. Sometimes that's to persist. Other times, it's to quit. Choice allows us to take back control, to be able to make that decision. It's a kind of superpower that brings back confidence, helps us wrestle with our emotions, and allows us to learn, adapt, and grow. So much so that people report that even if the choice they are given during a task is completely meaningless and inconsequential, that demanding task feels a bit more enjoyable, a bit more manageable. If we want to develop tough individuals, we've got to put them in a position to make decisions and empower them to do just that. For far too long, we've trained helplessness. The football player who is told to perform burpees until he can't. The teacher who is told to follow the lesson script exactly and docked when they deviate. We've turned our world and much of our training into a version of the VO2 max treadmill experiment. Survive or quit. It's time to expand instead of constrict. Give people a choice and let them train hopefulness. The second pillar of toughness. Listen to your body.